Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. My name is Sarah Clark, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this FedSoc webinar called The Return of the Monroe Doctrine, Venezuela, Ecuador, and American Foreign Policy. We're very pleased to welcome a terrific panel of legal experts today. Professor John Harrison is the James Madison Distinguished Professor of Law and Class of 1941 Research Professor of Law at the University of Virginia School of Law. In 2008, he served as counselor on international law in the Office of the Legal Advisor at the U.S. Department of State. He worked with the Department of Justice from 1983 to 1993, serving in numerous capacities, including Deputy Assistant Attorney General and the Office of Legal Counsel. Professor John Yu is the Emanuel Heller Professor of Law at the University of California at Berkeley. He is also a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and a visiting fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. He has served in all three branches of government. He was an official in the U.S. Department of Justice, general counsel of the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee, and a law clerk for Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas and Federal Appeals Judge Lawrence Silberman. Our moderator, Jeremy Rabkin, is a professor emeritus of law at the Antonin Scalia Law School at George Mason University. Previously, he was a professor in the Department of Government at Cornell University for over two decades. He currently serves on the board of directors of the Center for Individual Rights. If you'd like to learn more about today's moderator or speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. Throughout the program, we'll turn to the audience for questions. If you have a question, please enter into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we'll do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers, not the Federalist Society. With that, Professor Rabkin, thank you so much for joining us today, and I'll hand things over to you.
Thank you. So I want to start with history, and I'll indulge myself in a moment of personal history. About 4 years ago, I saw that someone pointed out to me that we were on the verge of the 200th anniversary of the Monroe Doctrine. And I tried to interest the Scalia Law School's National Security Institute in doing a program on the Monroe Doctrine. And mostly I was met with, oh, yes, the Monroe Doctrine. I'm pleased to say that today you don't have to give a justification for a program on the Monroe Doctrine. Suddenly it's very alive and current and people are really interested. I want to start with just a very brief account of where this started, not with me, but with Monroe. President Monroe's annual message to Congress, the 7th, December 2nd, 1829. There was not a lot of fanfare about this. I looked this up in Richardson's messages and papers of the presidents. That message is about 13 pages, and maybe one of them is on the foreign affairs issues that we've taken now to be the Monroe Doctrine. The particular provocation of this was the so-called Holy Alliance, this alliance of European monarchs that wanted to prevent the return of principles of the French Revolution, principally the Austrian Emperor and the King of Prussia, and the Bourbon monarchy in France. talked about the possibility of reclaiming Spanish colonies in the New World, as well as repressing revolutions in Europe. Secretary of State John Quincy Adams seems to have persuaded President Monroe to put in a few lines in his address announcing American opposition. The gist of this is in one sentence: "We owe it to candor and to the amicable relations existing between the United States and those powers, these European powers, to declare that we should consider any attempt on their part to extend their system to any portion of this hemisphere as dangerous to our peace and safety." It doesn't quite say we will immediately go to war, but it says if you do this, you're going to in some way provoke some kind of reaction from the United States. So I want to start with John Harrison, who has more history under his belt and is adjacent to Monroe as the James Madison professor at Virginia. Was that a doctrine of international law? How should we understand that? Did that have any legal status, really?
I think that Monroe was trying to create a principle of international law at a time when the extension of the European state system and the rules of international law and respect for sovereignty to the Americas was something that was being sorted out. Where there had been colonies, now they were former colonies, first the United States, then the Spanish colonies. Given that the relationship between a state and a colony is not the same as the relationship between two sovereign states, such as existed in Europe, like between the Bourbon monarchy and the Habsburg monarchy, Monroe wanted to say, and there's a principle of international law of no interference, including no interference to restore colonialism here in the New World. And with any principle of international law, one of the key questions is, who's going to back it up? And the United States was saying, and we're prepared, like you said, not necessarily to go to war, but to take this seriously and regard something as a hostile act. So I think he was trying to make a new principle of international law.
There's quite a lot. I mean, the whole thing is not that long, but in the two paragraphs in which this is discussed, there's quite a lot about our system in the United States is fundamentally different from the political systems of Europe, not just by geography, but in principle. We our governments rest on consent, and we are states that respect individual liberty, and they don't in Europe. Does that have anything to do with the international law principle?
I think not so much. That is to say, the difference between the American republics and European monarchies and empires, I think, was for Monroe and Adams a reason to have the principle of international law. It was to respect the American republics and their choice of republicanism, that he said, and you have to respect their sovereignty the way you would respect the sovereignty of another European state.
But do you think it is not about respecting republican government, but just respecting independent governments?
I think so. Again, I think the contrast between European monarchies and the American republics is a reason for the American republics to be worried about the imperial ambitions of the European powers. But I don't think that Monroe was saying, oh, it would be okay to interfere if a monarchy sprang up here. No, I think the principle was, no, you're not allowed to get involved here.
Well, I'll ask John Yu, if a Latin American country wanted to have foreign sponsorship and even foreign affiliation with a non-Republican state and an illiberal state, would that trigger the concerns of the Monroe Doctrine in the way that Monroe formulated it?
Yeah, thanks, Jeremy. I was just going to say quickly, I'm sure I speak for all of us, thanks to the Federal Society for putting this together. Mm-hmm. And it is particularly great for me to be on with Jeremy Rabkin and John Harrison. I'm getting old, but I was once a student and read their books when I was in school. So they're really old. So this is a real pleasure to be here. And I actually had the pleasure of editing John Harrison's article on the Privileges and Immunities Clause back in the day, which has absolutely nothing to do with this topic.
I just want to say I really enjoyed editing your work.
Well, Jeremy edited my work when we wrote a book together, and he found my work substandard. It took him a lot of time to fix it. But actually, the book that Jeremy and I had together, which was 10 years early, right? Because our book is about AI, drones, and robotics and space weapons, really ahead of its time. The timing is everything. But actually, some of the things we argue about in that book are germane to this podcast or webinar and the question. So I think that at the time, I agree with John if he's implying that at this time, there was no international law that prevented the European states from coming back and trying to recolonize South America. And if the United States was trying to create such a rule, we failed, right? Undeniably, right? The colonization continues, right? The Africa is split up. European empires don't seem to obey any kind of principle against colonization, nor does the United States, because after the War of 1898, we're quite happy to colonize the Philippines. So I don't think there's any, if there was an effort by Monroe, and I'm not sure he was intending that, there was no international law that came into existence out of the Monroe Doctrine. Instead, and this goes to Jeremy's point and his original question, is I think it's really a principle of just foreign policy that the United States was going to try to use its power, not international law, to try to prevent European nations from re-entering the Western Hemisphere. And then, I think this is right, because if it really were a principle of international law, then Jeremy's question that a country in South America could voluntarily welcome back a colonial empire from the old world would have to be respected, right? It would be the voluntary choice of a nation. But if it's a principle of more hard power and strategy and not international law, then the United States would still try to stop a country from the West, I'm sorry, a country from old Europe from re-entering the hemisphere. Because, and I think this is also fair to say, most American strategists agree, no matter all the disputes we're having about Iran or Venezuela, which we'll get into, I think they all agree that after protection of the homeland, the second most important goal of American foreign policy is to prevent any hostile power or competitor or challenger to the United States from having any position in the Western Hemisphere, that we should make sure the Western Hemisphere is kind of sealed off in terms of these political connections from either Asia or Europe, so as to secure our backyard or our neighborhood, as it were.
So I'm not sure that's right, but assuming it's at least partly right, but it seems to be a principle of foreign policy because people kept repeating it over many decades. Does that have any legal weight even within the American legal system? Or is it like an executive order, one president proclaims it and the next can just say, never mind, I don't agree with that?
Me or John?
Do you have an opinion about that?
Well, I think this goes again to the themes we talked about a little bit in our book together. The question has to be whether... you're laughing, but I have like many of the many unsold copies. 1% of them are behind me. I think the question then becomes, are we going to have a international law that applies to everybody in the world, a kind of thick international law, or is what I think is happening? And I think you do, Jeremy, but I'm not sure. We haven't talked about it in a little while, whether there's a kind of thin international law that will apply to all countries that's going to recede back from the hopes people had after World War II. But because of that, there's going to be regions of the world or groups of countries that are going to develop a thicker international, like the democracies or like the United States and Latin America. So you could see a Monroe Doctrine becoming a principle that the United States and South America follow. But we're not going to claim, for example, that applies to China and Taiwan or to
the Latins used to Eastern say Europe. They used to talk about the international law of the Americas. Yeah. So I just want to spend just a few more seconds on this. John Harrison, do you have an opinion about whether something announced as a doctrine or repeatedly reaffirmed as a doctrine of foreign policy has any kind of legal claim? There you go. Yes.
I think
legal claim on a subsequent president.
Okay, two points. And first, sort of before that specific question, I want to say something more, because I think it's interesting about how international law works, about the idea that in addition to being a principle of U.S. foreign policy, the Monroe Doctrine was an attempt to create international law. One reason, and I don't know how much like John Quincy Adams was thinking this, but one reason to see it as a potential piece of international law is the United States could make the case to the European powers that it would be in your interest to have a rule like this, that Great Britain in particular did not want once again to be excluded from trade relations with Latin American countries. That had been going on, you know, Francis Drake, that had been going on for a long time. And this is a little more speculative, maybe the United States could sort of sotto voce say to the European powers, if you mutually agree not to get into fights in the Americas, you will free up resources to do other things in Europe or elsewhere in the world. So it would be a useful coordination point. As for the question, is it, when considered as a piece of American foreign policy, is it something that an American president can just turn on and off? I think it's mutable like any principle of policy, but it's not easy to turn it on and off. Because often what presidents and the people who support their policies want to do is create a long-term constituency domestically of people who are going to support this, so that Congress is going to want this to happen, so that, you know, people who are selecting the next president are going to want this to happen. So a successful policy can perpetuate itself that way by creating a domestic constituency. And I think that could happen with the Monroe Doctrine, because there were lots of Americans who wanted, you know, kind of what Britain wanted. They wanted to be able to have relations with Latin American countries and not have to check with somebody in Europe first.
You might make a small point, a follow on to John's historical point is that may be true. I'm not sure if that really is how international law is formed, but this would be worth historical investigation. But I don't know if the United States even believed it, because, right, what happened in the Civil War, right? The Europeans come back and they recolonize Mexico. Abraham Lincoln's president, our greatest president, one of our greatest presidents, I think maybe he's the greatest president, but did he get up and say, that's a violation of international law, right? This is the norms that we have agreed on and we persuaded you were in your interests and our interests. Did that happen? Obviously Lincoln was busy, and I don't know if he could make arguably the claim that this was a violation of international law. Certainly, I don't think that Britain and the other European countries said, you have violated international law by sending those, you know, renegade royal, you know, bloodlines back to Mexico to take over again. I think they just treated it as, right, here's hard power, great power politics, seizing a moment of vulnerability on the part of the United States. And what good did international law do?
Well, you could always ask that question about international law, right? So just one more quick round on this. I'm struck this term doctrine, which we use for important foreign policy statements. I'm not aware that we do that ever in domestic policy. Presidents will talk about, President Biden talked about how important it was to have DEI and inclusiveness. No one called it the Biden doctrine. It was just something he said. You can enact a lot of legislation. People don't call it a doctrine. President Roosevelt's package, people called it the New Deal, but they didn't call it the Roosevelt Doctrine. Is there some significance to the term doctrine, which has a suggestion of like it's a legal doctrine?
Either it's a very interesting point. That's a very interesting point that only a Straussian would make. You guys care so much about the meaning of words. Oh. No, I actually don't. I think that's a really good point. But also, here's the other flip side. You don't usually hear about international law being described in doctrines either. Right. Yeah. Like we don't have the right self-determination doctrine in international law. They call it, think of principles. It would be interesting to know, because as you point out in your quote, Monroe doesn't call his own principle a doctrine. It's right. Interesting. But by the time of Teddy Roosevelt, they're talking about the corollary to the doctrine. Yeah. So at some point,
it didn't take that.
Yeah. Yeah. At some point, they start calling these doctrines. But I think that actually has to do. Maybe I'm wrong. This has to do with the slipperiness of international law. Maybe, Jeremy, your last point about does international law ever make a difference? Maybe this is part of how international law tries to give itself the patina of real, you know, positivist law, like the kind we have in domestic law, where we talk about doctrine all the time. And then also, and this is pure speculation, Jeremy, but do you think maybe the other place you hear about doctrine is religion? And so does it have something to do with claims that international law comes from some, I mean, the principles do come from natural law. Is it an appeal to sort of the Christian Roman foundations of natural law or civil law, which is the root of a lot of international law, says effort to try to claim the garb of legitimacy where in international law, I think John was saying this, has very, very difficult legitimacy grounds.
There are things that are in some way authoritative, but not laws. But anyway, okay, fine. So
let's, Jeremy, can I? Yeah. Something interesting in picking up from what John just said. I can't think of anything in the 19th century that was called a doctrine. Like, for example, did the Republicans say no slavery in the territory doctrine? I don't think so. But it is true in 19th century political rhetoric that you will hear people just in general talking about the doctrine of the Republican Party or talking about the creed or the faith of political parties, thinking that political parties are supposed to have some coherent body of ideas and analogizing them to religion. I think there's a functional explanation for that, which is a way for political groups to organize coordination over decades and with a lot of people who don't necessarily agree with one another on everything, is to have some well-established principles. And well-established principles like that can be defined as doctrines, creeds, and faiths. And I think they then take on it, they then have political power. That is to say, once people think, these are the ideas that unite us and enable us to work together. Those ideas come to matter.
So, but those are doctrines that are not really about international law. Doctrines.
American principles of politics. Yes.
Yeah. Because you think a lot of things we call doctrines in foreign policy are not about international law, like the Truman Doctrine, or you could go on the Reagan Doctrine or the Carter Carter Minor Doctrine. Yeah. Everybody wants a doctrine, but they don't have to do with this is international law. This is our foreign policy.
We're not going to be able to get to Ecuador if we stay bogged down.
I don't ever want to get to. Let's keep talking. I don't want to get to Ecuador. Let's stop at Cuba.
One other question that is related to this, let's say, foundational discussion about the meaning of doctrines and how they relate to international law. It seems that the original formulation of the Monroe Doctrine was against recolonization, establishing direct, open, formal control. Whereas in recent times, people have said it's very alarming that China now owns port facilities in Panama. It's very alarming that China is establishing not just commercial relations, but a kind of economic leverage on states in Latin America and in the Caribbean. Is it just free association, or is it a reasonable extension of the Monroe Doctrine to say we should be wary of that and not just direct formal recolonization. You want to take that first? John, you.
Well, I think that the Monroe Doctrine has this dual personality, which you're suggesting. Is it about protecting the self-determination rights of people in Latin America, or is it really about advancing American foreign policy interests, which is to stop foreign nations' rivals from setting up outposts in our backyard? And recall, we're all old enough to remember Jean Kirkpatrick's famous essay, where she said, sometimes in order to defeat the larger threat of the Soviet Union or international communism, we have to ally ourselves with dictators. And I think that's the more modest version of the Monroe Doctrine that doesn't get caught up in sort of more, I think, esoteric, but, cutting edge flavors of international law today about self-determination. It makes more sense for the United States just to use as a doctrine to limit the influence of our rivals. So, for example, and it goes to your initial question, Jeremy, if Panama has a democratic vote and they vote to let, let China control the two sides of the Panama Canal in terms of the facilities, they, under the treaty, they can't actually hand over the sovereignty over the canal zone without our permission, but they can let the Chinese companies run either end of the facilities. I think the Monroe Doctrine in that narrower form would allow the United States to intervene as we have. Or Venezuela, I think you could see the dual personality in how we treat Venezuela. We respected the results of the Venezuelan elections long ago that initially put this current regime in power, even though it turned to become an outpost for Iran and China. I wonder whether the sort of more aggressive form of the Monroe Doctrine that was probably, I think, more along the lines of what John Harrison was describing, where it's more wrapped up with self-determination, would say we still have to respect the choice of the Venezuelans from that election, and everything that's happened since then has been formally legal under their constitution. I would think that the real heart of the Monroe Doctrine is to stop Iran and China from setting up shop in places like Venezuela.
So as long as we've come to the 21st century, maybe we should stay there for a bit. I think it's right that we accepted that Hugo Chavez was legitimately elected, at least at some point. Maduro, in the most recent election, whenever that was, 2 years ago, we did not accept that he was legitimately elected. And I suppose it engages all the dualities that you were talking about. Is it any of our business if he wasn't legitimately elected? Or is it just our foreign policy concern that he's becoming dangerous because he's a tyrant who needs to have props from outside Venezuela?
I would have said, the hard facts of international relations are that it's the foreign policy. So in my mind, suppose there were a democratic election and the country there said, we actually love China and Iran, and we democratically welcome them and ask them to set up bases. I think the Monroe Doctrine, properly read for an American president, would say you have to stop that. But under international law, was currently formulated, and sort of the Monroe Doctrine version of turning it into a pro-democracy principle, would say the United States shouldn't. And I think that would be a big mistake. And you can see how, with the case of Venezuela or maybe Cuba, has shown how harmful it is to our interests.
Even as a foreign policy matter, if we say that we have legitimate right to police our neighborhood, and to make sure that within our neighborhood or our hemisphere, we have only compatible regimes, doesn't it give an opening to Putin to say, I cannot have a big country on my border that wants to join NATO?
So are you switching to Harrison yet? Are you still? I think this is what international law, if international law is becoming more rules for different regions, and the interesting question then is, Russia has sort of claimed this suzerainty over the former territories of the Soviet Union. And the interesting thing is, somewhere in Ukraine, there is a line between where we allow, we effectively have allowed Russia to run many parts of it. But Ukraine, you know, there's people who argue this really goes back to issues about under the Austro-Hungarian Empire, there are certain, or even the Roman Empire. But that's what the fight of Ukraine is, where that line is. Yes.
If only Samuel Huntington were still with us to.
Well, this is kind of a seance for him, isn't it? So, but one last point is, in response to your hypothetical, I think that at the same time, we would not allow Putin to dictate terms to Poland now, or to many of the countries that used to be part of the Warsaw Pact, that they have rejoined Western Europe. And then part of our, you know, what I think of as the regime that we're building for the democracies. But Ukraine is the battlefront of where that line between us and Russia is.
It's the greater Western Hemisphere.
Mm-hmm. Or the Alliance of Democracies, whatever you want to call them.
I think the point you're making is right. That is to say, if the United States is trying to enunciate principles of international law, one feature of principles of international law is they apply to all states. They apply reciprocally. And so one of the strongest arguments that a government can make in favor of a position of international law is, we respect this for you, so you have to respect it for us. That is, we do in fact treat you reciprocally. Whereas for principles of foreign policy, in contrast with international law like we've been talking about, you know, it's much more every state for itself. Here is what we are going to do. So yes, if the United States were trying to say there's a principle of international law about we get to manage our own backyard, then yes, Putin and other similar heads of government would have a comeback, which is, wait, that's not international law, because international law is supposed to be common principles that everybody can coordinate on. And if they work, they are common principles that everybody can coordinate on, but it's a feature of them that they're supposed to be universal.
Yeah, thank you for that. I mean, that seems to me a real contending claim. So I'll stick with Joan Harrison on this. What was your feeling about the abduction of Maduro and the forced change of at least governmental orientation in Venezuela? Did you think it was against international law? And second, even if against international law, might it have been a good thing to do anyway?
I think it was contrary to international law. It was contrary to the UN Charter. I haven't gone back and looked again at the Rio Treaty, to which the U.S. and I believe Venezuela are parties, which is a regional security arrangement. I think it's also contrary to the Rio Treaty. I think the question whether it might nevertheless have been a sort of morally and policy wise justified breach of international law is another question. Maybe because I'm not sure what I think, but maybe. But as far as I can see, it was contrary to U.S. treaty obligations.
So I think that is a very compelling argument. I mean, I think it's hard to maneuver your way past, yes, the Rio Pact and the UN Charter and all that. What about Cuba? We are now really squeezing them. I suppose you could say we're free to trade with who we want to, but I think we try to prevent other people from trading with them. In particular, we've now told Venezuela, don't send them oil, which seems to have been like greatly exacerbating their economic turmoil. Would you say that is legally questionable?
I think not. I want to hear what John Yu has to say about that, even though, Not surprisingly, for a long time, lots of Latin American governments have been saying that economic sanctions are a form of coercion that's inconsistent either with customary international law or the Charter or the Rio Treaty. I think that's not right. I think that international law does draw a meaningful distinction between the use of force and the use of what might be quite coercive economic tools. So I think the United States is okay on that. But it's long been subject to, no, this is in fact aggression. It's just not being done with gunboats. I think that's wrong, but lots of people have been saying that for a while.
Yeah, I'll just mention, I mean, the Latins within the OAS voted in 1961, something like that, 62, to expel Cuba from the OAS on the grounds that it couldn't be a Marxist regime and be part of this organization, because the organization was dedicated to Republican government. So Cuba has always been, I shouldn't say always, it was for a long time considered an outsider. And then I think the Obama administration agreed that they should be allowed to come back into the OAS, although I think they haven't actually rejoined. But it's, I mean, there are interesting legalities about the government of Cuba also. So I'm not certain that all the Latin countries even today would be rallying to Cuba's defense. John, you think, I guess on your doctrine, we could do anything to Cuba because it's our neighborhood.
Yeah, I mean, let's go back and look at the Cuban Missile Crisis, where all the complaints about the, right, this is held up often as JFK's greatest moment as president and one of the great moments of any president in the post-war period, and putting up a quarantine. They just called it a quarantine as a matter of rhetoric. It was a blockade. It was even more than what John Harrison's talking about. It was an outright blockade of Cuba, which is an act of war. And this was the right thing to do, right? This was effective foreign policy. It also, I don't think, had the effect of changing international law. I think in the end, the other countries of the world didn't buy our claim that we could enforce a quarantine. And now we allow quarantines all over the world by, you know, seafaring powers. There's no reciprocity to it. It was just an act of war, you know, dressed up as.
It's fortunate for us there aren't other naval powers.
Well, there's one less now than there was a few weeks ago.
But the American Journal of International Law did raise this point. They published an editorial saying this is not consistent with international law.
Mm-hmm. This is an act of war, like John just said.
Yeah. And I want to make to follow up on John's point about Venezuela. I totally agree with him that under formal international law, as it is read and taught, you know, our intervention in Venezuela is a violation. The idea that if you just apply the UN Charter and Article 51, the only thing you could say in the U.S.'s behalf is that it's trying to make the claim that Venezuela attacked us first by using drug cartels as a kind of non-conventional. Yeah, John's already shaking his head as a sort of non-conventional means. And I actually think this more ties into the domestic issue, too. You would want to see the president convince our domestic institutions of that first before we try to persuade the other nations of the world that this is really a principle of international law. That it could be dependent on the facts. I could see some situations where another country using non-conventional asymmetric forms to attack us, like terrorist attacks, would be the same as a conventional armed attack. But the facts are not there yet. I mean, unless the Trump administration has a lot of facts they haven't produced in public.
Does it make a difference that the vice president of Venezuela said, oh, sorry, okay, yeah, sure, happy to go along?
There is this issue in international law, whether after you win, getting the people you put in charge to retroactively consent cures the issue. And, you know, sometimes countries in the world are much more favorable to that than before, right? This came up with the Iraq War. This came up with the Iraq War where, you know, of course, we had this big fight over whether the invasion of Iraq was legal. But then the UN kind of blessed it after the fact by, you know, issuing a resolution about rebuilding Iraq, and the Iraqi government, the democratically elected government afterwards, is, you know, retroactively approved it. But that doesn't answer the ex ante question of whether it violates international.
In response to something you said a moment ago, I think the quarantine was an act of war. I think that the situation in Cuba was closer to legitimate anticipatory self-defense than anything I know about with respect to Venezuela. There were nuclear missiles in Cuba. Yes. A threat to the United States. I think they hadn't risen to the point of where a preemptive strike would be permissible self-defense, but it was closer than anything, like I say, anything I've heard of in Venezuela.
I agree. I mean, I think the question of Venezuela is whether you're willing to accept that a country could act through, right, the proxies of drug cartels or terrorist groups that would be sufficient. Now, maybe there's a lot more that Venezuela is doing to us that we don't know about because of intelligence and so on. But you're right, publicly, the data that's out there. But right, the interesting thing is the United States is pushing that claim in federal court right now. They've lost, right? This is also their underlying, the Trump administration's underlying justification for the deportation of Venezuelans, right? They're invoking the Alien Enemies Act, and they've made the exact same factual claim, but it's had no success yet. But I would, maybe this is maybe not to Jeremy, but this is one thing that the domestic war powers debate could do. It would be very good for the president to tell the other branches what this information is and this intelligence is, to at least persuade it about the use of force under our domestic law. It has this corollary effect of maybe helping us with our international opposition too.
I totally agree with that, both domestically and internationally, that U.S. presidents should always make the case for what they're doing in both of those fora, and especially domestically, should say, this is why this is a good idea. This is why Congress should be behind us and not trying to interfere.
It can't be a doctrine unless the president articulates it clearly.
Those are the kind that work best.
Yes.
Something people can understand and say, yes, I'm.
And also, maybe to go farther, Jeremy, you could say, and over time, the branches buy into it, right? So if you want to say there was a Monroe or is a Monroe doctrine, Congress has frequently funded the forces necessary. I mean, if you want to, you know, it'd be, you know, if you want to look up, I mean, there are dozens of examples of American presidents intervening in Latin American internal affairs, and Congress, you know, has never cut off funds for that.
I want to just pause over the, come back to our preoccupation with the term doctrine. People use this jokingly, the Monroe Doctrine. is there some principle or precedent that's been established by Trump's intervention in Venezuela, which a subsequent administration could take up? Like, does it stand for anything except it was a special case and we did it?
No, I don't know how the Trump application of the Monroe Doctrine is really that different than other presidents, or to put it differently, wouldn't you have expected Teddy Roosevelt to have, right, also intervene in Venezuela under current circumstances? He would intervene just because the South American countries wouldn't collect enough customs, right, in their touch to pay off their loans to Europeans.
I think that is different because he was afraid that the Europeans would then intervene. It was to preempt European intervention. Yes.
And it was to collect the customs that had been the pretext for the intervention in Mexico while the U.S. was distracted by the Civil War.
Yes. But in terms of like threat to the U.S., I think much smaller in terms of national interest than Venezuela being an outpost for China and Iran.
We were concerned about your, like, I mean, it sounds funny today, but we were concerned that the Kaiser would send gunboats to Venezuela, actually.
Yeah, which that's true.
What triggered the Roosevelt, the Teddy Roosevelt doctrine?
And in with Maximilian, and can any government so constituted long endure? That is to say, is popular Republican government an option even in the Americas? Well, they were trying to set up an emperor.
Okay, before we turn to questions that we've gotten from our audience, do either of you want to say anything about Ecuador? Because we probably talk about
it. I think it's a typo. I think AI meant Cuba.
That's right.
I didn't see anything going on in Ecuador, but I think Cuba is really the next case, not Ecuador. I hope Cuba is the next. I hope Ecuador is not the next case for U.S. intervention.
Regard to Cuba, I think you've both been accepting that we can have economic pressure on Cuba. Would it be a big leap for us to have some kind of military action there, given that Russia is so preoccupied that it's not really a meaningful sponsor of Cuba anymore?
This is an interesting issue of diplomatic history, because there's always this belief, I think, that one of the ways that the Cuban Missile Crisis was resolved was that the Soviet Union promised never to deploy nuclear missiles to Cuba again, and we promised never to invade Cuba. So this has never been written down. I'm not sure whether there actually is a text, but and there's no president who's actually said that was the deal, but a lot of diplomatic historians think that's what something like that was done by the Kennedy administration at the end. So this would be an interesting test of the Monroe of doctrine and the Donald Trump corollary, whatever it is, whether he'd be willing to break that agreement. I actually don't think he would, but I agree with John. There's a lot of things the United States can do, which are a sub, you know, military force, which could effectively cause a revolution in Cuba, like telling our now newfound Venezuelan friends to stop selling oil to Cuba. There's nothing, that's not an act of war or violation of the principles of formal principles of international law and the UN Charter. And Jeremy, as you pointed out in your pieces, which I very much like about the use of force in international affairs, there's a lot of things we allow in economic sanctions that are just as damaging, if not more damaging, than kinetic military strikes, and international law permits it. So I don't see why we couldn't just continue this policy without actually having troops sent in, which would violate, you know, this 60-year-old agreement we've had with the Russians.
And I think, assuming that's true, and people certainly think it happened, that if the United States makes a political commitment in order to resolve a major crisis, then I would say even 60 years later, the United States should adhere to that.
You know, it was a commitment to the Soviet Union in a wildly different context, right? I mean, but okay. We've had several questions here, which I think are really to John Yu to start with, which generally are, if you say that...
You know, Harrison, as usual, has seated the audience with his former students. This happens all the time.
Ah, okay.
Sorry.
But I think they're like
horrible. I mean, they're good questions. Just kidding. Just kidding.
Harrison was obviously right. So let's.
Doesn't it undermine the idea of international law as law of any kind if you say it doesn't apply to powerful countries or it doesn't apply to regions which have opted out because a powerful country has said we're all opting out together? But let me just read the challenge. Yeah. I think is what these questions were aiming at. In your mind, or in your public doctrine, let's call it, what's left of international law? What is it that the United States absolutely should not contravene?
So John raised some of these points in his very first answer to your first question, where he talked about, well, this has to do really with how does the Monroe Doctrine has to really do with how does international law form and really what is it? Does it make a difference? And so I would say international law is what the most powerful countries in the world make of it. And it always has been. And we've lived in this idyllic period since 1945, where the United States, I think, created a set of rules and tried to enforce them, which were in many ways more beneficial to the rest of the world than to the United States, perhaps. It's really beneficial to us, but maybe even more beneficial to the rest of the world that we tried to rebuild after the destruction of World War II. So I don't really buy the idea that international law is really different than what the most powerful countries in the world think it is. And if it is, it's not going to last that long, and that the powerful countries will reset it to something that suits their interests. So I think, what is it that international law still is, if it's not just, I think, a reflection of the power relationships which create the international system at the time? I think John mentioned, I don't know if he meant to limit international law to this, but I think the initial thing it does is it allows for coordination of countries in their common interests. So of course, you know, basic forms of it are like, don't kill ambassadors, you know, allow things that allow diplomatic relations to occur. Maybe a default that existing borders are to be respected because it creates a certain stability in the international system. And if you don't at least minimally respect them, except for certain types of situations where they pose threats to your national security, the whole system becomes unstable and unpredictable. So I think there are, I think what international law really is the countries of the world setting up rules of coordination. And the reason why there's so much stress, and I think the reason why this, these events in the Western Hemisphere are occurring, the events in Eastern Europe are occurring, or in the Middle East, and why we're having meetings like this is because I think the power structure in the world is changing. The post-war system is coming to a end and it's turning into something else. It's no surprise that the international law rules will become uncertain because they're going to shift to follow whatever comes next. And I think we're in this transition period. It may be that maybe the United States comes out ahead of all this. Maybe China recedes as a threat. Maybe Russia loses in Ukraine. Maybe we succeed when our goals, whatever they are, in Iran, and we're able to restore something like the post-1945 order. Maybe it sounds like 1979-80 again, where, you know, Reagan comes in and stops the retreat of America and our principles. But I think if that happens, it's only because of American power. It's not because international law somehow stopped the major powers of the world from reshaping the system as they want.
John Harrison, you want to make a stronger defense of international law?
Well, I'm gonna say something about what international law, and a point on which, John, you and I agree, which is its coordination function, can do. And I hope that in whatever the coming era looks like, we don't end up in the situation that often happened in the Cold War, where each of the superpowers in the Cold War would back one side in a conflict between smaller countries or two medium countries, because I think smaller and medium-sized countries might well be able, much better than superpowers, to have a rule of coordination among themselves, respect the charter, respect the non-use of force principle, and it's in the interests of the greater powers not to get pulled into the conflicts of the smaller countries that they have some connection to. So I hope, sort of as a means of coordination, that in the next era, greater powers will be prepared to say, we're not backing our friend to the hilt, and you shouldn't back your friend to the hilt either, because that's in both our interests.
I do wonder whether the United
States... Jeremy, what do you think? Well, Jeremy, what do you think about it? What's your answer to this question?
I'm just the moderator.
Oh, no, come on. Come on. See, this is what he would do when we were writing this brilliant book. You would always pull that on me. Come on. What's your answer?
Like Tucker Carlson, I just raised a question.
You're just asking questions.
You're just throwing it out there. No, but what's your answer?
I put this in the form of a question, but it actually reflects my opinion, which is I don't think we are able to be quite as cynical about this, we, the United States, as many great powers in the past, or Russia today, or China today, because we are a republic. And if the United States acts in a very brutal, cynical way internationally, it makes people, it sort of undermines their confidence that the country rests on certain principles and a respect for law. And I think it's one of the things that is breeding distrust of Trump's actions, which probably could be defended if you had a really good speechwriter and were really careful in how you presented it. But it looks like Trump bullying, because we see him doing that at home. And so it makes people uneasy.
Yeah, I just make a point about that. So, but isn't that because people are distrustful, not of the means, but the goal? And people, I mean, in other countries are distrustful of Trump's ultimate ends. So if you had a Reagan, right, or actually any number of the American presidents after 1945 who would say, you know, we have to have distasteful allies, perhaps, or we have to invade other countries, but it's for the greater good of spreading this system of, right, free markets and Republican government as far as we can get it to go. Wouldn't countries like say, okay, we'll accept the Cuban Missile Crisis, or we will accept I don't know, Vietnam, or we'll accept Korea, or we'll accept NATO as the price of it.
This could be, and certainly when, you know, we had a real war, when we fought World War II, we didn't let ourselves get distracted by international law, rules about neutrality or any of that. But I was really putting this not in terms of what other countries would accept, but how the American people take it.
Okay.
And I think that matters over time. So you're getting now a reaction, which I don't think yet is that large. But there's a lot of skepticism about what Trump is doing. I mean, in American politics, some of which is, isn't this impulsive? Isn't this bullying? Isn't it really lawless? And I think it would be helpful for the people conducting American foreign policy to cultivate at least some appearance of concern for international legalities. But I'm not stamping my foot and saying everyone has to agree with that. Anyway,
no, this is the Straussian in you coming out, because this is you want noble lies spread left and right to the American people when they have to do tough things and make them not think that it's for real power projection and protecting our stake in the world, but for greater moral good.
Who said this? But somebody said a gentleman never insults other people unintentionally.
What a quaint concept.
Yeah. That's just good statecraft. Whether a country is a republic or a monarchy or whatever, not insulting anybody by accident, that's just rationality.
Yeah, so I can tell neither of you truly understand social media.
And related to that is a certain, showing a certain regard for legality. But anyway, we've run out of time because our hosts have to make a few statements. It was a good discussion. I'm sorry we didn't get more deeply.
Thank you.
But maybe the next.
Let's have another one if Sarah will allow us.
This is good.
Sarah, thanks, John, over to Jeremy. You. Thank you to the panelists. Thank you,
Sarah. Thank you.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, thank you so much to Professor Harrison and Professor Yu for speaking with us today, and to Professor Rapkin for moderating. We're so grateful for your time and expertise on this important topic. Thank you to our audience for joining us. We really appreciate your participation. You can also stay up to date with other announcements and upcoming webinars on our website, fedsoc.org. Thank you once more for tuning in, and we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.